This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, John Fogerty, was the lead singer and songwriter with the band Creedence Clearwater Revival. Between 1968 and 72, the year Creedence broke up, they had several gold records, as well as 8 top 10 singles, including Proud Mary, Bad Moon Rising, Green River, Down on the Corner, and Looking Out My Back Door. For many years, Fogerty refused to perform the songs that made him famous because his old record company owned the rights to those songs. But Fogerty returns to those songs on his new live CD, Premonition. VH1 will air an hour-long tribute to Fogerty, followed by the concert which is featured on the CD. It will be shown June 10th, 12th, 14th, and 27th. Before we meet Fogerty, let's hear one of his signature songs, the song which opens his new CD, Premonition. John Fogerty from his new CD, Premonition. John Fogerty, welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, thank you. Hello.
The songs on this CD are songs that, you haven't been performing for years. What are the reasons why you didn't perform your old Creedence songs for so long?
Got a minute?
Yeah.
Well, they're pretty well-known reasons. I had an awful lot of trouble with the first record company, the record company that Creedence Clearwater recorded for, which was Fantasy Records in the Bay Area. And even though the band broke up, they owned my contract. And I ended up with lots of legal fees and being in court all the time and suing. And, it was just kind of a nightmare. And all of that got attached in my mind or in my being to the very songs I had written. It becomes a situation where the thing that you love most also becomes the thing that caused you the most pain, and it's really hard to deal with. So for many years, I tried to divorce myself from my own legacy, you might say, from my own life's work. But that was the reasons for not doing the songs. And then much later, a lot more recently, really, I had a kind of, I want to say premonition, but that wasn't exactly it. But I came to a point where I had healed emotionally to enough to where I felt like reconnecting with my own past.
Did you miss the songs in the years that you weren't singing them? I know that there was a lot of negative stuff attached in your mind to those songs and a lot of contested money. On the bright side, a lot of performers who are best known for their work from the late 60s and early 70s are sick and tired of those songs and feel so sorry that they're forced to do it whenever they perform. Whereas I'm sure for you, those songs are really exciting and fresh to do now.
Very much so. It may be something like the famous Muhammad Ali rope-a-dope, where I was saving myself, for later rounds or something. I enjoy, these songs are so much a part of me. They reflect my personality and things that I love so much. I still feel that way. Proud Mary very much reflects my love of Americana, a time, let's say during Mark Twain's era, when there was a lot of romance about the West and the Mississippi and that sort of thing. I tend to romanticize things, but, you know, that a little of that can go a long way.
Do I understand that you spent some time in the Mississippi Delta while preparing your previous album? What impact did that have on you and on writing new songs and thinking about your old songs?
Well, as a matter of fact, the fact that I became emotionally healthy and more willing to do my old material is a direct result of those visits to Mississippi. And it's a really strange thing. I mean, this isn't something I totally understand, but I'm really glad it happened. I started getting this very strong urge to go to Mississippi around 1988. And I ignored the call, you might say. I couldn't understand why I was feeling like I should go. I didn't have a clue what I would do when I got there. Like I say, I just kept putting off the urge, but the urge was very clear and very strong. So I finally went for the first time in 1989, I think. And I still didn't know why I was going, but eventually what happened was I found myself at the mythical gravesite of Robert Johnson. There was no big neon sign or anything. You had to kind of weed through folklore and a lot of, you know, books and stuff to figure it out. But I got to where I felt he was probably buried, and there was a tree that's in the stories that you hear. Anyway, while I was standing there and pondering Robert, I started wondering who owned his songs. In other words, Robert is gone, but the songs live on, and they are great songs. And for some reason, it was a curiosity to me. Well, I wonder who owns these songs. And finally, I decided it doesn't matter who owns the songs. Robert owns the songs. You know, I'm standing here where these songs came from, and I'm standing here at Robert's resting place. And as far as I'm concerned, Robert Johnson is the spiritual owner of his songs. And this is a long anecdote to say that the minute that thought passed through my mind, I realized there was a great parallel with myself. You know, I'd come a long way to visit Robert's grave. And I thought, wow, you know, this is kind of like me, except it would be a shame if, you know, 50 years from now, some guy's standing at my gravesite going, gee, I wonder whatever happened to John Fogerty. I wonder who owns his songs. And then that guy would probably say, it doesn't matter, John is the spiritual owner. And the minute I realized that there was a bit of tragedy in all of that, I started thinking I should do something about my own connection with my songs. After all, I am the spiritual owner of my songs. And most other people from the outside think of me as the owner, regardless of the real legal or financial ramifications.
You've written a lot of songs inspired by the South, like Born on the Bayou. You were actually born in El Cerrito, California, near Berkeley. And I'm wondering why in some of your songs you wrote first person in the persona of a Southerner.
Gee, that's a good question. I think I was trying to place myself in this mythicized and romanticized territory. It's a mythical world, kind of, that I created. Certainly, musically, it's a mythical world. And why I use the device of first person, I think I realized that talking about the main street of El Cerrito probably wasn't going to be something that was widely understood or even cared about. It didn't seem very interesting to me anyway, and the South has always fascinated me, and that's really the reason, the reason that I placed myself that way in my own songs. But if you want to ask me why am I so fascinated about the South, I really have to confess I don't know.
Because of the music?
Most of what I know about the South came through music, particularly the early forms of rock and roll, meaning rhythm and blues, country blues and country music. And again, all those versions, I believe, were pretty romanticized. They, you know, they were sort of rainbow-colored visions of the South in most cases.
Would your father have ever said what the father says in Born on the Bayou? Papa said, "Son, don't let the man get you and do what he done to me."
Yeah, he did say that a few different ways. My dad was a dreamer, unfortunately. He wasn't much of he didn't find great success in this world. But he was quite a dreamer and pretty literate. He read all the time and he was inspired by all kinds of people that he passed on to me in kind of little snippets. I can remember when I was very, very young, my father reading the story of Dangerous Dan McGrew over and over. He loved that particular poem. He really loved Ernest Hemingway. You know, he was a product of the 30s and 40s, I guess. My parents certainly were Depression era people, and I learned a lot of those lessons at their knee. And I think just by the way my dad ended up living his life, just by example, really, he was telling me, don't let the man get you and do what he done to me.
John Fogarty, do me a favor. Can you say two words for me, turning and burning?
Well, when I'm sitting here quietly in a library atmosphere, it is turning and burning. But when I sing, it always comes out toinen and boinen.
Yeah, I know. That's very New Orleans, isn't it?
Well, you know what? I didn't know where, really. Although I've noticed, because I just did it naturally. When I wrote the words, I wrote them to sound that way.
And the song in question is Proud Mary. Yeah.
Right. I've also noticed, though, that Howlin' Wolf has very much that sort of dialect in his music. I only spoke to him a couple times, but in his singing, you know, in the great songs that he did, he pronounces those words that way. But yes, down in New Orleans, a lot of people will say toinen and boinen.
Well, why don't we pause here and listen to your new recording of Proud Mary from your new album, Premonition. My guest is John Fogarty. John Fogarty from his new CD, Premonition. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with John Fogarty. On his new CD, he does the songs that he first recorded with Creedence Clearwater Revival. The members of Creedence started performing together, I think, in 1959 when you were all in high school. Do I have that right?
That's correct. Actually, we were still in the eighth grade, three of us.
Junior high school.
Right.
What were your early songs? What was the band like back in eighth grade?
Well, we were mostly an instrumental band. I patterned myself and my band very much around Duane Eddy, and we did several Duane Eddy instrumentals. We also had probably 10 or more instrumentals that I had written. Not remarkably original, really, but, you know, they were... I would play the taking the pattern basically from Duane, I would play the melody on the guitar, and Stu, who was not yet playing bass, was playing piano, and I had kind of showed him the rudiments of, three-note chords and a little bass line. So at that level of our development, we were certainly learning the rudiments of music, but always with a rock and roll flair, you might say. Rock and roll has some pretty strict parameters that when you step outside those parameters, everyone kind of gives you that crossed finger look, like they're holding back a vampire.
Mm-hmm.
So I've always kind of based everything from the center of rock and roll.
The band's first name was Tommy Fogerty. That's your brother, Tommy Fogerty and the Blue Velvets. And then the band was called, what was the second name?
Well, actually, originally, the three of us were the same age in the eighth grade. So we were just the Blue Velvets.
Oh.
And then we got the lucky happenstance to make a few records for a little local Bay Area label. And under that guise, Tom would join us. Tom, by that point, I think was out of high school, and of course we were still in high school. And under that recording name, we were Tommy Fogerty and the Blue Velvets.
And then what was the next name that you used?
The next name on records was the Gollywogs.
And what was the Gollywogs supposed to mean?
Well, this is one of those deals, because you're young and everybody else is supposedly older and wiser, and it's their record company. What the real story is, we worked on the first song for about 9 months. I mean, we had gone in there and recorded it, and we kept pressuring the record company to, when's it coming out? This is all of 1964. And then finally they tell us, well, the record's here, the pressings are here. So we rush over. Actually, I rushed over to San Francisco, and I pull one. It's your first real record on a supposedly national label, Fantasy Records, and you want to look at this thing. And you take it out of the box, and I looked at it, and oh, my God, it said the Gollywogs. So Max was one of the brothers that owned the company then. I said, well, geez, Max, there's a mistake here. There's like a typo. They put the Gollywogs. No, we decided to rename you guys. Oh, well, why? See, a gollywog is in England, a gollywog is like a voodoo doll. It's this doll that comes from Africa. It's really a hip thing. It's really cool. And it's black, too. It's like from the black culture. And it's really cool. It's like a voodoo doll. And in England, it's really a hip thing. Of course, in 1964, the British had arrived in America, and all things English and British, mod, etc., were very cool. Unfortunately, no one in England had ever heard of a gollywog either.
How did you come up with the name Creedence Clearwater Revival?
Well, of course, after struggling under that name for several years, the ownership of Fantasy changed. And the very first thing we wanted to do was change our name. And the guy that had bought the company, the new owner of the company, agreed with us that we could change the name. I think he hated it too. And so we set about for many months trying to come up with a name, but none of it was very suitable or remarkable. The whole process started to bog down. I think it was Christmas Eve, and I was watching television, and two commercials came on television, one of which was a beer commercial that really promoted its use of the water. And they were showing this lush green woods and this flowing river. And, the place looked enchanted. And there was this beautiful music in the background. And right after that was a black and white commercial. It was an anti-pollution commercial. And it showed all kinds of pollution and garbage in the water and that sort of thing. And at the end, it said, if you want to change things, right to Clean Water, Washington. And I was really taken by the two things back to back, the beautiful clear water and the, terrible polluted water. And clean water stuck in my mind. I started playing with that. Clean water didn't seem like a very good name for a band, but I evolved to clear water. And I remembered back to when we had toyed at some point with the name Credence. It's not true that I ever knew this person, but we did know of a man whose first name was Credence. Pretty unusual name. And, of course, I shuffled that around. Clearwater, Credence, Credence, Clearwater. Oh, I kind of like that. But it still didn't sound complete. Remember, this is during the era of Jefferson Airplane and Strawberry Alarm Clock and Buffalo Springfield. So I kept playing around with different words, and I thought that what we were really doing was having a revival. The group, we had been together a long time, but we were now experiencing a revival, or at least I hoped so. So finally, after about probably 10 minutes of thought or even less, I had come up with the name. And I must say that the name was much better than we were at the time.
John Fogerty, he'll be back in the second half of the show. His new CD is called Premonition. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with John Fogerty. He's best known as the former lead singer and songwriter with Creedence Clearwater Revival. On his new CD, Premonition, he does new versions of the hits he had with Creedence, including Proud Mary, Bad Moon Rising, and Born on the Bayou. Creedence Clearwater Revival had its biggest hits between 1968 and 1972, a bunch of top 10 hits. And you were based in the Bay Area, around San Francisco. San Francisco at that time was dominated, you know, in the public mind by groups like the Jefferson Airplane and the Grateful Dead, the kind of psychedelic bands. Where did you see Creedence fitting into that California scene of the time?
Well, since I had grown up so much with a fondness for blues and R&B and particularly rock and roll, my work ethic, you might say, was somewhat different than what I perceived the work ethic, if you can even use that term, of people like the Grateful Dead. And so I noticed that our music, or our approach to music was, or at least mine, was far different than the other bands that were becoming famous in San Francisco. But politically, I felt very much as part of the feeling of people in the Bay Area or San Francisco, or really my generation in general.
You wrote some politicized songs that pertain to the draft and to the war in Vietnam, like Fortunate Son, which is a song about how privileged people make wars, but the sons of the privileged are exempt from fighting them. And Who'll Stop the Rain, I think, was perceived as an anti-Vietnam song. I know you were in the reserves for a while. How did you end up in the reserves?
I was a very lucky guy, really. A local sergeant in a reserve unit took pity on me and basically let me join his unit when, the unit was full and there was really no place for me to go. He basically took pity on me and let me get into his reserve unit at the time.
So what year was that you were drafted?
1966.
So you were already recording then?
Oh, yeah.
And you didn't want to go to Vietnam, so you ended up in the reserves. I'm wondering if being in the reserves affected your attitude toward the war or toward the kinds of songs you wanted to write.
Oh, I would say very much, because, you quickly learn when you become a grunt in the military that you're just a number. You're just a piece of meat. You're nothing. You have no rights. You have no privileges. You have no power over what happens to you. And that's a very debilitating feeling. And I can remember the night I finally arrived at my boot camp after being shuffled around for a couple of days, really. And it's your first day, and they keep you awake forever. You seem like you've been awake. And somewhere around midnight or 1 in the morning, all my guys got marched off to get our hair cut. And you kind of come back, you feel like you've been sexually abused. You know, you come, they say, okay, go back in there. And you go back in your barracks, and there's like 30 other people in the same boat, and you're all a bunch of ugly eggheads. And I laid down on my bunk, and I must confess a few, my eyes certainly watered is, I guess, what I'm trying to say. Of course, you get over that because you're supposed to be a man. It was probably the most forlorn feeling I've ever had.
Did you see your song, Who'll Stop the Rain, as an anti-war song?
Yes.
Why don't we play that now? We'll play the new version from your new concert album, Premonition. Do you want to say anything about writing this song before we hear it?
Well, of course, the rain is a metaphor for the gobbledygook that comes down from the places on high. And I was feeling pretty much powerless at the time I wrote this song. And I was trying to reflect that really it seems to be, it has gone on since the beginning of time. And even at the time of the Vietnam War, when there was so much protest in the air, I had a very fatalistic point of view. It seemed like all the protesting in the world wasn't going to change anything.
This is Who'll Stop the Rain from John Fogerty's new album, Premonition.
Long as I remember, the rain been coming down. Clouds of mystery pouring, confusion on the ground. Good men through the ages, trying to find the sun. And I wonder, who'd stop the rain? Shelter from the storm, caught up in the fable, watched the tower grow. Private plans are nudie, wrapped in golden chains. And I wonder, who'll stop the rain?
That's John Fogerty, a new recording of his song, Who'll Stop the Rain, on his new album, Premonition. Did you hear from people who were fighting in Vietnam that they played your records there a lot and that your records mattered to them while they were in the jungle?
I would hear that off and on right around the time of 1970, 71, but I heard about it a lot more later as I began to become an adult. And guys who were now back and settled into the community would tell me all kind of stories about Vietnam and the music that they experienced there.
And what did that mean to you?
Well, in some cases, it was very uplifting. I am proud that the songs meant so much. You know, I realized, of course, that all the music at the time meant so much, and especially to Americans off in a foreign land in a jungle fighting for their life. I mean, anything, these are kids, these are guys 20 and 21 years old. Anything that is a touch of home is a very welcome memory at that time.
The records that we've heard today are all new versions of your early songs. On your new CD, you have one new song that you haven't recorded before called Premonition. And I'd like to end with that recording. Would you tell us something about the song?
In my mind, this is just a rock and roll song. It's not really from personal life, on my part anyway. It was, at least to me, a really fun song to play live. It was a good vehicle for the band to play in front of people, and it was something you could get right away. It was a song that wasn't, you know, real difficult to get on one or two or listenings, and that's really what I was after.
John Fogerty, a pleasure to talk with you. I want to thank you very much and wish you good luck with the new CD.
Thank you so much.